Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. It's been about 6 months since the coronavirus outbreak was declared a pandemic. Working from home, along with government restrictions to isolate us as much as possible to slow the spread of the virus, have led many, maybe most of us, to experience a condition being loosely referred to as quarantine fatigue. While researchers work on vaccines, others on improving testing, with contact tracers trying to head off outbreaks before they get underway, we do our best to get comfortable with the mask, the distancing, some of us discovering our inner solitaire, okay with the slowdown, stepping off the hamster wheel, others of us feeling pent up, restrained. This quarantine fatigue doesn't affect everybody the same way, but emotional stress is at its core, which can only be expected in a time of lost income, isolated work conditions, a lack of human companionship, or all of the above. Often when we are in contact with others, we're having a really hard time knowing how the heck to answer the question, "How are you?" Paying close attention to all of this is Dr. Seth Himmelhock, chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Kentucky. We've invited Dr. Himmelhock to help us bring some definitions and understanding to the things we're feeling and experiencing as this pandemic drags on. Here's part one of a two-part conversation. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Himmelhock.
What a great pleasure, Tom. Thank you for having me on today and allowing me to have a discussion with you about this extremely important topic.
Your field focuses on the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of mental, emotional, and behavioral disorders. First, speaking broadly, and we'll get into specifics in a moment, what sorts of issues triggered or revealed by these pandemic conditions are you and your colleagues noticing?
Yeah, so first I would begin by acknowledging that we're living in really challenging times. As you noted at the beginning of your show, that there are so many things that are going on in our lives today that are different than even 12 months ago, that are creating so many challenges for so many people in the community, whether it be financial issues, the isolation, other things that are just going on in life, whether it's school-related, with children doing online schooling. And what I would say, though, as an important beginning point, is that not all stress is bad. We as humans are hardwired to experience stress and to manage it pretty well. And in fact, some stress can encourage us to do really great things and become better than our usual selves. But sometimes when people are encountering lots of stress, they can develop symptoms that may be different than they normally encounter in their day-to-day behavior. And what I like to think of those symptoms is people getting stuck in just one feeling state. They can't really change the way they feel. During the course of the day, it's very normal for people to cycle through different emotions. People can be happy, feel sad, feel anxious, feel pleasure. But sometimes people, when they encounter stress, can get stuck in one emotional tone. For example, people can only start feeling depressed. And when that happens, other symptoms may come along with it, such as feeling loss and pleasure of doing things, or not eating enough, or not sleeping well, or not feeling like you have enough energy. If those symptoms all occur, that can be a syndrome that mental health professionals call depression. And what we're seeing in our practice in psychiatry is definitely people calling in to report more depressive disorders and more anxiety disorders. So people are also experiencing having feelings of worry that they can't shake. And those feelings of worry might be associated with other symptoms like upset stomachs or shaking hands or other things that are not normal that they experience in their everyday life. So people, again, getting stuck in that one feeling state, not being able to shift out of it, that's a signal that something's not going quite right. And it's an opportunity for people to get help. Fortunately, we have been hearing from people who've been requesting that help. Honestly, what worries me most is the people we're not hearing from. The people who may be in situations where they are feeling stress and the stress is leading them to have the symptoms, such as ones that I've mentioned, and are not getting help. And for those people in particular, I would say that there is help. And there are various ways to get help. One important way would be, you know, if a person's feeling so stressed out that they're thinking of harming themselves or ending it all, the first thing to do would be to call 911. Or if that didn't feel quite right, there's the National Suicide Hotline that also is available. And the number for that is 1-800-273-8255, which also has the symbol of talk. And I would say that those are two important things for people to have just in their pocket during this time, just in case either themselves or someone they love may have an issue. So I would say that those are the things that we're encountering most, is people reporting more depressive symptoms, more anxiety level symptoms. The other thing I also want to draw our attention to is that sometimes during these episodes where people feel more stressed, people can turn to the use of drugs or alcohol. And in particular, alcohol, if used in moderation, is probably okay for most people. But if people are using more than they feel comfortable with, or they notice that it's not helping in the same way, or people are letting them know that they're using too much, those are probably indications that someone may need help. And again, there are lots of available places to get that help. And if they need the help, there is a national hotline through SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Agency, that I can also share with you, which is 1-800-662-4357 or help. And again, those are things that people, again, I think should just have in their pocket.
Dr. Himmelhock, we're hearing about some of those things that you mentioned before, the anxiety, stress, depression, exasperation with the state of things, from people who don't ordinarily express those types of concerns. Are these pandemic conditions revealing truths about us that we have managed to suppress or even ignore?
You know, stress can do a lot of different things to different people. And we've talked about some of the things that, that stress can lead people to feel worse about themselves or activate behaviors that may not be as helpful in their day-to-day living. The other thing that stress can do is allow us to develop resiliency and find ways to be even better than we could have imagined. So during times of stress, people can sometimes be very innovative and solve problems that they had not thought of in the past. For example, if someone hadn't, were used to having conversations with people for their job face-to-face, and now they're finding themselves having to do it on Zoom, but in their, a moment of ingenuity, created some product or something that helped them to have those interactions in even deeper, more meaningful ways, that could be a great solution, not only for themselves, but for others who find themselves in that place. Or people can turn to creative outlets where in the past, we were busy commuting to work or doing other things that were not potentially creative. Having that time available to one could allow them to do, more artistic adventures, such as creative writing or painting or drawing or things like that, that could allow them to have deeper access to themselves and others around them. So, when you ask about, does it reveal things about us? I think it sort of reveals the best and maybe the worst in us. It's an opportunity for us to learn, a bit about both. Neither of them is wrong necessarily. It's just different ways in which humans tend to react to stress.
Okay, let's dig down into some of those specifics that I mentioned before. First of all, concerns have been voiced by parents and teachers that not allowing football to start when it was promised could have a very negative impact on the mental state of students. Should they be concerned about that?
I would say that organized sports in high school are extremely, extremely important. They build collegiality. They allow people to compete with each other in safe ways that allow others to feel proud of the work that they've done. They allow the individuals to achieve in ways that are meaningful to them, their families, and their friends. And I think that most people would say, as long as the sporting events are happening in a safe and monitored way, in general, in the outside of the COVID situation, doing sports is a really good thing, very healthy for physical and mental health development for most kids. That being said, we are living in a different period of time where, you know, we are experiencing COVID, and COVID is a social phenomena. And what I mean by that is the infection is spread through social contact. And the remedy for that, of course, is to limit social contact, obviously by social distancing, wearing masks, quarantining if needed. And obviously, we would want to be in a situation where, you know, many sports are social. So how do you do it in a way that not only allows the athlete to feel and their families and friends that they're achieving, but to do it in a way that's safe and minimizes risk for the community? Now, that's outside of my, you know, knowledge or what I can say or do. That's really up to the community, up to the government, up to the state to make those decisions about what is right and wrong for the athletes in terms of participation and risk. But my guess is that if it's done in a safe way that allows people to understand how these athletic events should occur in a way that's meaningful and safe, that I think most people would be willing to understand that sometimes the community needs to be privileged over the individual. That being said, I imagine that, you know, if sporting events were not allowed to take place, that would have a certain negative impact on people, in particular people prepared for a long time to do the sporting event and wanted to reap the benefit of doing that. And I would just say that if people are feeling upset or feeling concerned about some of those feelings of not being able to do exactly what they want to do because of those limitations in the sporting atmosphere, given COVID, that they reach out for help to their coaches, to their friends, their family, and to the system of care that can help them manage those feelings.
We're talking with Dr. Seth Himmelhock. He chairs the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Kentucky. Another specific, freelancers, the many of us who had been making livings in the gig economy, and I think that that's nudging around 40% of the workforce now, are now at a point where savings have dried up, bills are mounting, money has run out, stress, the negative kind, is rising, and there's no end in sight, it seems. Is this as dangerous as it sounds?
The way you're describing it, it seems like a perfect storm of, you know, impossible levels of stress. And I would agree, I would be concerned for some, for sure, especially, as you noted, people who may not have as many social contacts or have the resources to allow them to succeed, you know, given the amount of stress that there might be there. But again, you know, just moving back to the idea that stress can be positive and it can be negative. And for some, this may be an opportunity to imagine different opportunities that may allow them to really promote their ideas of resilience and have a very positive outcome. But for others, obviously, it may be much more difficult. And I really do feel for those folks who are managing in this economy with the social distancing and all the impacts that it has. So again, I would say, you know, going back to the beginning, if people feel the symptoms of stress that may lead to more negative types of behaviors, like only feeling one emotion all the time, that is the real call to get help. And I just want you all to know that help is here, and we certainly want to help you. And the numbers that I've suggested could be one way to access that help. Clearly, reaching out to family and friends is another way. But you're right. It's a very, very, very challenging time for that particular group of people.
For young people, I'm talking about high school, college, young adults with dreams of career, romance, adventure. These have typically been the most free years of life. Can we expect that COVID restrictions will turn out to have profoundly altered this period of their lives and, as a consequence, their long-term mental well-being, mental health?
Yeah, I imagine that this will be one of those points in life where everyone will say, you know, where were you during COVID? What did you do during COVID? And people will share their experiences and how they managed to get through it. I have two college-age daughters. Both of them are home right now doing coursework online. And one of them has already said to me that she's not planning to be at home come the spring. that she would prefer to be with her friends. And what I mean by that is, if we're still living in the social distance world with, because COVID's a social phenomenon, we have to keep safe, that she would do that in a safe way, but live with friends as opposed to living with her parents. And to my mind, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, kids, when they're moving into the age of going to college, one of the big developmental milestones, of course, is independence, learning how to be an adult, how to take care of oneself, how to manage all the things that one needs to do during the course of life. So in some ways, having college-age students be at home can have a negative impact for them. They can feel it as being stifling or not as helpful. And so what I would say is, certainly for some who are experiencing not going back to college, this could be impactful in that way. For those who are going back to college, they may be feeling the freedom and the spirit and all that, but may also be feeling the confinement that the appropriate social distancing and mask wearing and all that requires. So again, it's a very, very challenging time. I do think that people are resilient, and especially younger adults are probably very resilient. And my hope is that this will just be a point in time where people look back and say, you know, what were you doing during COVID? But again, there's always people who may be at risk. And for those who are feeling symptomatic or feeling the symptoms that I've talked about earlier, it's really, really important to get help sooner than later. And help is there for those people.
Dr. Seth Himmelhock, chair of the psychiatry department at UK. We covered a lot of ground in this interview. Part two, next week on Eastern Standard. For many weeks now, we've been featuring public school teachers and superintendents around Eastern Kentucky, describing for us how they're trying to organize and manage teaching and caring for children in a time of such uncertainty and unpredictability. Well, now, series co-host Tanya May takes us down the road in the other direction, to the state's largest city, where the County Board of Education expects to get a plan this month for how Kentucky's largest school district will determine when to reopen its classrooms.
We are here today with Dr. Marty Polio, the superintendent of the Jefferson County School System. Dr. Polio, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
According to the National Center for Education Statistics, Jefferson County is the 29th largest school district in the nation. Can you provide our listening audience some additional background information about the Jefferson County schools, including the number of students that you service?
Sure. We're made up of 98,000 students approximately and 155 schools and a host of other programs that we support, very diverse student population. We are right at about 50% white students and 50% students of color, and about two-thirds of our students are free and reduced lunch. Additionally, we host about 11,000 English language learners from other countries all across the world, 13,000 students who are special education students, and approximately 6,000, maybe more now, with the COVID-19 that are homeless. So a wide variety of students and schools, but it's also great to be a part of such a diverse student population.
I know just the size of your district alone and the number of students you serve, in addition to some of the other unique characteristics such a large district houses. What were some of the significant challenges that your district faced when schools had to close very suddenly last March?
Yeah, well, the biggest challenges was really around that NTI, non-traditional instruction, was really designed by the Kentucky State Legislature for small, mostly rural districts around 2013. And the thought process was, were these districts that have to cancel multiple days throughout the school year because of weather conditions and road conditions, that they could use this non-traditional instruction to support kids learning and they wouldn't have to go deep into the summer for makeup days. Large districts never intended, it was never designed for large districts just because of many of the challenges. So when we went into NTI or thought about going into NTI, First of all, most large districts aren't prepared to do something like that. Second of all, we know that in a district like ours, there is such a digital divide with students who have means to have connectivity to Wi-Fi, high-speed internet, a device, and those that don't. And it's clearly marked on our, if you looked at a map of our city, a heat map of the digital divide, you would clearly see that. NTI would exacerbate things like the achievement gap for kids who don't have access to a device and high-speed internet. So that was a huge challenge for us. And really moving to this model with nearly 100,000 students in the matter of 2 weeks was a challenge. But I think we did our best to mitigate those issues, get students as many Chromebooks and access to connectivity as we possibly could so that we could provide good instruction. And we saw really positive participation rates out of our students. But it definitely, we faced a lot of challenges, as all large urban districts did around the country.
Certainly, certainly. So moving on to thinking a little bit about the reopening plan for this fall, can you talk to us and describe that plan for us and give us your potential reopening date?
Yeah, so, well, when we first were looking at, as soon as we got solid into NTI in the spring, we knew it was now time to transition into what reopening would look like. Like most people following, we felt that there would be a decline in cases in the summer, but that at some point we might have to go back into NTI late fall, early winter because of this, what was so-called second spike that might occur in the winter months. But we were definitely preparing to go back to school at the start of the year. And then in mid-June, we've got the guidelines for reopening, which in a, without, you know, with being very candid about it, I mean, those are very challenging for any school district to implement the CDC guidelines, whether that's masks, cleaning, temperature checks, social distancing. And I think we're seeing that in schools right now. That's very challenging to do. And the larger the district, the more difficult it would be to implement those guidelines. So we were very worried about that, how we were going to do it. But we were still focused on going back 5 days a week, but also offering a virtual option for families who did not feel safe coming back to school. As we moved into late June and mid-July, and cases began on the rise here in the state, we became very concerned, and especially here in Jefferson County, when our positivity rate on COVID cases on tests eclipsed 7%, and we were seeing it throughout our community. And so that became a big worry for us. We started looking at what that would mean, the amount of faculty and staff that we have that are high risk, and the amount of students that are high risk. We made the determination in mid-June that we would not be able to return to classes and that we would start in a remote setting in non-traditional instruction for 6 weeks. So we are going to be back in NTI for the first 6 weeks, and then we'll monitor it and hopefully come back either to in-person or a hybrid model at that time.
With the remote learning, can you talk to us a little bit about how that will look or work? Will students meet synchronously with their classmates at regular class times? Will it be more independently driven work? Are alternate grading scales being considered? Will that look different from school to school? Can you just talk us a little through how that remote learning is going to work
for these first 6 weeks? Yeah, sure. So we're doing what's called NTI 2.0. So we're looking at what we did well in the spring, what we didn't do as well as what we wanted to do, and making improvements for the fall. So we know, first of all, our expectations on teachers and students are going to be higher than they were in the spring. You know, we've got to improve on that. We're going to focus, obviously, on new content, new learning, which is going to mean more synchronous instruction. You know, we are still going to be somewhere in the middle between synchronous and asynchronous. We know there has to be flexibility. We know that teachers have their own children in their house, many of them, and will be providing NTI for those children as well. We know that parents work and sometimes might not be able to support their child in learning during certain hours of the day. But we definitely want more synchronous instruction. We want our schools contacting and having touch points with students on a daily basis instead of what was in the spring on a weekly basis. And so we're picking up the intensity of that. You know, the KDE benchmark is a child was participating if they had contact once a week. We're now moving to a daily measure on participation. But we definitely want more synchronous instruction, higher expectations out of students, higher expectations in grading. Now, I will say this. I mean, I still think that we need to, as a school system and as a state, have flexibility with students, give multiple opportunities for students to be successful on assignments, projects, assessments, and really moving towards a more standards-based approach to grading. And when you move into a standards-based approach to grading, kids have multiple opportunities to be successful, and schools are a little more flexible when it comes to deadlines. Our goal will be that students learn the content, that they demonstrate proficiency in that content, and that we are able to ensure that they meet the standards. So that's really some of the things we're changing as we move into fall NTI.
You mentioned the digital divide. So can you talk to us about what type of accommodations the district has been able to provide for those students and families who do lack access to those technological tools they need? Have you been able to secure outside funding? What help will be available for those families and students?
Sure. So in the spring, what we did is we knew we had about 55,000 devices in schools, and we kind of faced that difficult decision. Do we leave them sitting in a school collecting dust, or do we get them out to kids? Well, we jumped on it. We sent out nearly 21,000 Chromebooks to our students in the spring. So about one out of every five students got one of our Chromebooks. Early in June, when we got CARES Act funding from the federal government, we ordered 30,000 more Chromebooks. So we are very close to, at this point, being one-to-one. So we're having all of those students who had a Chromebook in the spring to keep that. We are adding 30,000 new ones to what we have now. So on Monday morning, actually, we will be releasing the online form where parents can request a Chromebook. We've also ordered 10,000 hotspots, and those hotspots will provide internet access to students and family, and we have about 15,000 more on reserve. Most of that is through our CARES Act funding that we got from the federal government, but we're willing to step up and make sure that if we're going to provide this remote learning, we've got to give our families and kids the tools they need to get that done.
So finally, what are your biggest concerns for the 2021 academic year?
Well, I mean, as a superintendent, I mean, obviously talking to all superintendents, we have a multitude of worries. If it were only one, we'd all be in good shape. But I mean, it really goes twofold. You know, number one is health and safety. I mean, that has to be first as everyone's priority as we're doing this. And there's a lot of debate about the impact of coronavirus on adults, on children, how it's spread. Long-term consequences. I mean, we still have so much unknown about this that we don't know. And I'll give an example. I mean, a month and a half ago, 6 weeks ago, we were told that children didn't spread the virus as much as adults. And a recent study has just said that, I believe out of South Korea, said that 10 to 19-year-olds spread it at the same rate as adults do. So things seem to be changing so quickly from month to month that it's hard to know a lot of the facts around this. And I think we continue to have a lot of unknowns. And therefore, health and safety is number one. So I've said all along in this that, you know, I have about 3,000 employees that work for us in JCPS that have some kind of at risk or have a high risk, a health high risk, that if they got COVID-19, they would be at risk for serious complications and even death. We have a multitude of students, thousands of students who are in that same category as well. And so making a decision that could impact the life of someone that goes to school, a student or a staff member, is by far the biggest concern. And for me, making that decision, any death above zero is just unacceptable. And we just don't know enough right now. And so that's always number one. But clearly, right behind that is student achievement and learning. You know, we know that remote learning cannot replace in-class instruction. That is just a fact, and research supports that. Now, some kids thrive a little better in that environment, but overall, you know, we're very worried about achievement and the achievement gap and how that will tend to expand as a result of COVID-19 and being in remote learning. So we're going to have to be very intentional when we do return about identifying students who have fallen behind, making intentional plans to provide interventions to get them caught up. And that will probably be multiple years you know, this will be a crisis in education across America and really across the world for years to come. So, you know, those are the two main things. I mean, there's a lot of other things obviously involved in that, but I'm always focusing on those two things as my main concerns.
Of course, yes. Well, we thank you for sharing this information. I know you face a very significant challenge by being the superintendent of such a large district. We appreciate your work on behalf of our students and families, and we wish your district much success in the coming year.
Well, thank you very much, and got one degree from EKU, so I'm glad to be back and talking to you.
Well, great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Tanya May from the College of Education at EKU with Marty Polio, superintendent of Jefferson County Schools. Tanya will be back in 2 weeks to talk reopening with Dr. David Gillum, superintendent of Madison County Schools. Coming up after the break, Keeneland has a new CEO and a plan for making the September sale work in a pandemic. Bobby Ann Mason has a new book and talks about it with Tom Eblin. And what's in a name? Why, MACED, the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, is now simply the Mountain Association. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We're joined by Shannon Arvin, who, it was announced this summer, succeeds Bill Thomason as president and CEO of Keeneland, making the transition from partner with the law firm Stoll Keenan Ogden, where she has served as Keeneland corporate counsel, as well as secretary and advisory member of Keeneland's board of directors. She currently serves as secretary of Horse Country, director of Kentucky Bank, director of the Lexington School, chair and director of Bluegrass Care Navigators, and past president of the Thoroughbred Club of America. Shannon has deep roots with Lexington's iconic racetrack. Her grandfather, W.T. Bish Bishop, was the first general manager of Keeneland when the track opened in 1936. Her father, the late William T. Buddy Bishop III, grew up at Keeneland, living in an apartment next to the clubhouse. Thank you for joining us, Shannon.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I have so many questions. So first, how has it been, I wonder, to step into an already complex leadership role in the very midst of a global pandemic?
Well, it's been interesting. I'll say that. We've learned that one of our favorite words is currently, because it really is an ever-changing situation. But I think it's just a continuation of what we need to do in today's world, and that's taking the facts as we have them and assessing them and using calmness and logic to come up with the best approach possible given the facts. And there have been some silver linings and will continue to be. Things will look different, but we'll get through it.
We'll talk more in a moment about how the pandemic is influencing things at Keeneland, such as the upcoming September sale. But first, another point of significance. You are the first woman in what has traditionally been a male-dominated industry to lead Keeneland. And I say that's significant. I wonder if you do, and does it signal to women in the horse industry that things are changing?
I think certainly. I mean, it is not lost on me that I am the first female, and I'm proud of that, and I'm excited about that, and I hope that it gives encouragement to other females in this industry and others that really it's just a matter of doing the best you can and putting your best foot forward day after day, and hard work really does pay off, and it's not perfect and pretty every day, but just that perseverance, I think, is really important.
Okay, perseverance is a good word for this next question. Let's talk about what's on your plate. Keeneland's 77th annual yearling sale, coming up on September 13th, running through the 25th. Recognized as the thoroughbred industry's most important sale, and if that wasn't pressure enough, it's going to happen in a time of enormous uncertainty brought on by the coronavirus pandemic. How will you manage this so that it's both successful and safe for consigners and buyers and everybody who has to be there?
Well, I think the safety is paramount, and Keeneland is known in this community, and it's earned its reputation for being a very responsible company. We take very seriously our obligation to ensure that the activities that we have out here are as safe as possible for our participants, for our fans, for our horsemen, for the people working out here. So we have worked really hard to put in place protocols that will make this as safe as possible. And we've also put in place mechanisms where people who can't physically be on the sales grounds, either because they're not comfortable or they can't travel or whatever their circumstances may be, are able to participate remotely. So we have remote bidding set up so they can bid online, watch the sales, follow the sales online, and bid online. And we also have telephone bidding set up so that we're able to have somebody here at Keeneland be on the telephone with somebody who wants to bid and have that interaction with a person that's actually in the sales pavilion.
Is it looking like most sales are going to take place remotely online?
I wouldn't say most. It'll be really interesting to see what percentage of our sales do take place online. We've looked at, in Australia, they've been doing this for quite some time too, and we've looked at some of their statistics. So it'll be interesting to see how those bear out. I think that we have protocols in place, and there will be a good number of people on the grounds at socially distanced locations, so that I'd say a decent percentage of the bidding will still occur on the physical sales grounds. But I'm hopeful that this remote bidding option provides a good opportunity to help the industry and the marketplace, and also can be one of those silver linings that gives us an opportunity moving forward to let additional people participate in the sale.
So you do expect people coming in. I'm wondering, where will they be coming from?
Usually we have people coming from as many as 52 countries. So I'm going to say that number will be a lot smaller this year. When they do come, we've got testing protocols set up so we can be sure that we're being responsible about people traveling from other locations to Lexington, to our community. And then once they're here, as I said, masks will be strictly enforced and they'll be socially distanced.
You mentioned protocols, and those are some of them. And most everyone except buyers will be required to test negative for COVID-19 within 10 days of coming onto the grounds. Why are buyers exempt from that?
The way that the sales work, if you are a consigner or the staff and you're working within the barns, it's harder to socially distance. You certainly can have masks on and you can practice reasonable protocols, but as a consigner or their staff or a Keeneland employee, you're in a situation where day in, day out, you are potentially interfacing with the public. If you're a buyer, there's less of a reason to be in an enclosed space. You can inspect the horses outside with a mask and socially distanced and handle that responsibly.
And will there be a limit on the number of people allowed to gather in a sales pavilion at any one time?
Yes. We have limited seating capacity, and then we'll be monitoring, certainly, the numbers in the sales pavilion so that that stays at a responsible level.
And I think I saw the figure, something like 4,200 yearlings are on sale this year. Is that a high number for perspective?
It's a customary number for September.
So do you feel ready, or do you feel prepared for this?
We feel ready. We are ready, and we're excited, and we are ready for September 13th to come.
Shannon Arvin is president and CEO of Keeneland, and we thank you so much for joining us, and good luck.
Thanks so much for having me.
On loan to Eastern Standard from the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, where he serves as literary liaison, Tom Eblin with one of Kentucky's most read living authors.
Bobby Ann Mason is one of Kentucky's most acclaimed novelists and short story writers. In 2016, she became only the second living author inducted into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame. Mason grew up near Mayfield in western Kentucky and now lives with her husband, Roger Rollins, in rural Anderson County in central Kentucky. This week, HarperCollins is publishing her sixth novel, Dear Anne. Set mostly in California during the late 1960s, it is a wonderfully written story that explores themes of memory, regret, and that age-old human dilemma, whether it is better in major life decisions to follow your head or your heart. I'm pleased to have her with us today to discuss Dear Anne. Bobby Ann Mason, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Oh, thank you. Hello.
Yes. Well, so without spoiling any surprises, tell us a little about the plot of Dear Anne.
Oh, well, Dear Anne, she's on a cruise ship in 2017, and she's thinking back 50 years to her life during the 60s. And she's in some kind of situation, we don't really know what, that's causing her to want to escape in her mind. And as she looks out on the water, she starts thinking about what if she had taken a different path in 1967? What if she had gone to Stanford University the way her mentor had advised her, instead of going to this little college in upstate New York for her graduate studies? So she starts imagining, what if she had gone to Stanford? How would her life have been different? And could she have imagined a different person to fall in love with other than Jimmy? And Jimmy haunts her. So we follow her attempts at imagining life at Stanford. And she wants to meet somebody else and have a different life in her imagination. But she can't get rid of Jimmy. Mm-hmm. So that's basically how it's set up.
Okay. Well, I couldn't help but notice some circumstantial similarities, at least, between the character Anne and the writer Bobby Anne. So I'm curious what inspired you to write this novel.
Well, that's interesting. I always wanted to be called Anne. I always preferred that name.
Uh-huh.
But I'm kind of teasing along the story. This Anne isn't me.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, you could probably find some similarities. But all writers tend to use their lives as grab bags for things to weave their fiction out of. But her story is distinct from mine. And although I did go to the Upstate College in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know you did get your graduate degrees in the Northeast after working in New York City for a few years. I'm curious if you ever regretted not following some of your UK undergrad classmates out to Stanford?
Well, that was sort of the question I set up for myself because I was inspired by those legends, the Kentucky writers who wound up at Stanford. I had the same writing teacher as Wendell Berry and Gurney Norman and Jim Hall and Ed McClanahan. They were older than me, so they were out there in the early 60s and totally involved in the counterculture. And I was in college. I was at UK, and I heard stories about what was happening in California, and I think it just sank into my imagination. Well, it was just a basic thing in my memory. And I never went to California until 1985.
Hmm.
And in writing this novel, which takes place mostly at Stanford, albeit in her imagination, I had never seen Stanford University.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept trying to make the story accurate. And my dominant questions were not so much about the characters and what they were like, but what was Stanford like?
Mm-hmm.
What was the weather? What plants did they have? Birds.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wrapped up in trying to make Stanford seem real. And turns out I couldn't go out there to check out what I had imagined until after I'd basically written the book and I got a chance to go to Palo Alto last September.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious how that was, though. Do you think you had gotten most of it right, or how did it feel?
Well, I did get it right because I studied the maps and people told me a lot of things. But what I hadn't expected, it was bigger than I had figured it out to be. And I hadn't counted on the magnificent trees. And so all of that I was able to plug into the book a little bit as I was finishing it up. And that pleased me, and I really liked the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I still wonder what would have happened to me if I'd gone there instead of staying in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn from writing the novel? I know often writers say that they learn a lot about themselves or about life. What did you learn in this one?
Oh, I'm not sure I could articulate that. I'm not sure it's new, but when you're writing the novel, you're so in the middle of it that you don't have a real perspective. I mean, you can work with the terms of the novel and you can figure out the characters and so on. But like, I have no idea how people are reading this, what they will come away with. And I didn't go into it with a notion that I was going to write about first love. Or that I was going to write about the 60s. I didn't have any grand plans. So what I learned is that a novel just lives somewhere else. You don't have these big ideas like I'm going to write about the 60s and the counterculture. Mm. That wasn't it. I ended up writing about Anne and a certain way of looking at one's life. And I'm sure people will find different things in it. But I think she's facing a question, like many of us may be facing during this virus. You know, she's looking back 50 years, and that's a very heavy thing to be contemplating, you know, because it takes a lot of courage to face forward.
Right.
To see where you're going. And I think maybe that's the underlying question, although she never says that.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's been the reaction so far? Have you gotten much good feedback on it yet?
Not much at all, but the early reviews, like the Kirkus review that I think libraries and bookstores pay attention to, that got a really strong endorsement, and a few other early things like Publishers Weekly, but my publisher saw it, and so I'm waiting to see what people are going to think about it.
Okay. Well, what's your next project, or do you have one in mind yet?
No, I don't. In the background of this novel was a book of short stories that I was going to call California Stories, because they all had to do in one way or another with California. So that's how I wound up going in this direction. So I may try to gather some stories.
Okay. Well, thank you for being with us today on Eastern Standard.
Well, thank you.
Well, yeah, the book again is Dear Anne, a new novel by the renowned Kentucky author Bobby Ann Mason.
Tom Eblin's author interviews are provided in partnership with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. MACED, the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, has been a part of the Central and Eastern Kentucky lexicon for more than 40 years. But after working with P&P Creative, a communications firm based in Mount Sterling, the organization now has a new name, the Mountain Association, a new website, new messaging, and new materials. Peter Hilly is not new. He's been president since 2015, and he joins us from Berea. Greetings, Peter.
Hi, Tom.
So why this change? Why now?
Well, let's take that as two questions. Why this change is maybe a good place to start. We go through a strategic planning process every 5 years to assess our work, but this question has really been ahead of us for longer than that. You know, MACED has always been sort of a funny name, hard to say. People don't know what it means. I remember the first time I pulled into a parking lot in Berea, and I looked up and saw a sign in a window, and it said MACED, and I thought, I wonder what that is. And that's probably a question that has remained in a lot of people's minds. Of course, that was an abbreviation for Mountain Association for Community Economic Development. So what we've done is just to shorten to those first two words of that longer name. But there are a lot of important reasons for doing this, not least of which is we wanted to really make ourselves more accessible, a little bit less obscure, and having an acronym that nobody can understand doesn't really help. And beyond that, there was also a real problem. If you do an internet search for our old name, MACED, you would find our website, but you would also find videos of people being maced by the police. And that's certainly an association that we did not want to have with our name and our work. So it's part of a broader effort that came out of our strategic planning process to make our work more open, more accessible. And in fact, our first goal in the new strategic plan is to align our work and our organizational culture with our values of equity and inclusion. And part of that is making sure that our messaging isn't something that's only accessible to insiders, that we're really building an open front door.
Peter Hilly, president of the Mountain Association, formerly known as the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, or MACED, based in Berea. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Tom.
Next week, part two of my conversation with UK psychiatry chief Seth Himmelhock on the pandemic and mental health. And we'll hear from Dr. Helen Boucher. She is chief of the Division of Geographic Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center in Boston on superbug resistance to medication, Kentucky's ranking as second in the nation for our use of antibiotics, and why that matters now more than ever.
Unfortunately, we have kind of the convergence of two epidemics here. So our patients with COVID-19 who are sick enough to come to the hospital are at risk of what we call secondary bacterial infections. And some of those, unfortunately, can be caused by resistant bacteria. So we're in a position where we need antibiotics to treat resistant bacteria potentially even more than ever if we want to save as many lives as possible from COVID-19. So really, truly a perfect storm.
And our next guest on Chris Begley's Future Tense series, Lexington chef and activist Dan Wu. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.